Last day tomorrow. I'll get everything perfect right. So the theme this afternoon is the freeing of the mind. A few years ago now, in Varanasi in India, where I go each year, there were some bombings. So in one day, 4 bombs exploded in the city. At the time, my daughter was there. It was about 2 or 3 days after I had left. I spend most of January and February each year in India. I had left, my daughter had stayed. And of course, I heard on the radio that there'd been some explosions in the city. And then, of course, there was no contact. I couldn't contact my daughter. I didn't hear for 12 hours or so that she was okay. And she was okay, of course. She had been walking down the street, and a policeman in India said to her, "Madam, you can't walk here because a bomb's about to go off." She said, "No problem. I'll go the other way." So, these are the kinds of things that can often happen in India. It's not a very good advertisement to come to India for retreat, is it? But also here, of course, and in many other places around the world, there's events of unimaginable horror. So as I reflected upon this, and of course that my daughter was so very close to it, made the reflection even more potent. I thought, well, what a mess this world of ours is in. And how has this come to be? How is it possible that some people actually even conceive of harming others in this way? So this is the subject of my talk this evening. So let's begin with some investigation and inquiry into the way we see the world and our relationship to it. What wisdom, I ask myself, do the Buddhist teachings have to offer about this situation? And as usual, I like to begin with some reference to the text and then endeavor in my own way to explain it. So there's a very famous sutta. It's called the Madhupindika Sutta or the Honeyball Sutta. Now, in Varanasi, which is India's most holy Hindu city in the middle of the north of India, quite near to where the Buddha gave his first teachings, there's still shops that sell the honey ball, the kirkada. It's a beautiful sweet. You put it in your mouth and the center just dissolves. I think it's the sweetest sweet I've ever had. Even sweeter than the halva I had last night. So, the story goes that if you understand this sutta, it's as sweet as a honeyball. So let's give it a try. It's not an easy sutta, so try to stay with me as we go through it step by step. The sutta explains what is known in Pali as Papancha or Papancha. And the word's usually translated as thought proliferation or the multiplicity of thoughts. So it refers to that thinking that we do, where we project onto the nature of reality a whole lot of thoughts, our own drama and catastrophe, about what might happen, for example. Or we see the world through the veil of our own projections. So the word papancha refers to the projection of mind that occurs through the process of perception and cognition. So, in other words, if I shut my eyes, open my eyes, I immediately know that here I am in Israel, in Andor, in the meditation hall, and I'm the one supposed to be giving the Dharma talk. So all of that comes in such a flash. This is perception based on memory from the past. So the text from the Honeyball Sutta goes like this. Dependent upon the I, E-Y-E, this kind of I, dependent upon the I and forms. So the I and the objects that we might see, and I consciousness, so the consciousness that we experience when we look at something. The meeting of these three things is contact, is seeing. With contact as condition, there is feeling. We heard about this in the instructions the other day. There's the feeling that's pleasant or unpleasant, or in between. What one feels, that one perceives. What one perceives, that one thinks about. So, in other words, we feel, we perceive, and then we think about it. And then, what one thinks about, that one mentally proliferates. In other words, we then start to think about our thinking. So, there's contact, there's perception, there's the feeling, there's the thinking, and then there's the countless thoughts about what we're thinking about and whether we should be thinking it or not and whether it's a good thought or a bad thought or in between, and the whole story rolls on. So this is papancha. The sutra goes on to say that this tangle of feelings, perceptions and thoughts influences us with respect to the past, the present, and the future. So the three fields of time as well. So it's not just projection into the future, it's memory from the past, it's we think about what we feel in the present, and then our mind also turns to the future. So in my own words, papancha is the way that we overlay reality, based on our past experiences, our distorted perceptions, perhaps our unconscious desires. So we find some people and objects and things attractive, and we want them. Desire arises. So an object of itself, or even a person, isn't desirable in its own inherent right. The mind gives the object the desirability. We want it or we don't want it, thank you very much. And And this movement goes on ceaselessly throughout each day. We're attracted, we're repelled. We like, we dislike. Or we don't care too much about it, we often ignore something. Papancha also involves thinking in terms of, in a dualistic way. So thinking in terms of self and other, me and the world. And to give an example of papancha, I think is probably the easiest thing, because the text, as I was looking at what I'd written here, it's getting way too complicated. So for example, some papancha that's occurred to me today. One of my sons is in Guatemala. He left Australia on July 12th with his wife to go to a really remote part of Guatemala, where his sister-in-law is working as on a voluntary project, as she's an engineer, and she's setting up a recycling project and a water purification system for a small village, and plus building playgrounds and things for children and doing all sorts of other fabulous and interesting things. So my son arrived there and sent me an email. "Mum, where are you? Haven't heard." So I replied. But then, of course, I've never heard back. So since the 24th of last month, I haven't heard. So I don't know where he is. I don't know what's happening. So I've sent texts and I've sent emails and I've sent a text to my daughter, "Have you heard from Gabe?" And of course, the I lands in the role of mother. So my text said, "I'm just having a mummy moment. Have you heard from Gabe?" But then, of course, thoughts roll on. Oh, there are lots of bandits in Guatemala. There are lots of kidnappings. My son loves remote places. He loves walking in forests and jungles. So, of course, the thought goes, oh, maybe he's been kidnapped. Oh, maybe he's been even tortured and killed. So this is papancha. And it's a kind of, it's a sort of madness of the mind, I must confess. So we have to see it. So we get very catastrophic and dramatic in our thinking rather quickly when we have some attachment somewhere. I'm freely saying I adore my children, and the eye lands on, you know, wanting them to be very safe. So I still don't know what's happened. I hope he's okay. But I can't do anything more than that, other than just see the papancha. So this is thought proliferation. So of course, over the days, I'm sure each of you has had a few thoughts about something. Some of you more than a few. So it's to see into the nature of this process that actually frees the mind. Now, there are four different types of papancha. The first one is papancha that's bound up with desire. So it's bound up with our expectations, our desires, our unfulfilled needs. And we project that onto others. We project that onto the situations of our life. And some desire might have arisen here for you. You might have looked at someone else and thought, oh, she looks very attractive. Or, oh, he looks very attractive. So this is desire arising in the mind. The second type is papancha that's bound up with view. So the mind that jumps to conclusions, opinions, prejudices, and has all sorts of preconceived ideas about things. So this is called ditti papancha, or papancha that's related to view. And the third type is mana papancha, so papancha that is related to identity or conceit. And it also includes pride. And of course, this word identity has within it the aspect of comparison. When we identify with being somebody or something, we also compare ourselves, and we are either less than, equal to, or better than. So this whole process goes on where we are in relationship to things and making ourselves either inferior or superior. You watch and see what happens. We might say, oh, I know best. I'm always right. Doing it my way is better than someone else's. And so on. And the fourth kind of papancha that's often spoken about is the papancha that comes through the distortion of fear. So fear distorts our perception so much that we don't see clearly anymore. The mind is not free. The mind is bound up with the fear. So the mind also embellishes the experience, and these are our daily life experiences, in terms of I and mine and myself. So there are three things that are called the springs of papancha. So that which waters it, makes it flow. And these three things are craving, conceit, and views, the different types of papancha. So this is mine, is based on craving. Or we want to appropriate something, we want to make it ours. This I am is a conceit or an identification. And this is myself, I'm a psychologist, for example, is a view. So all conflict, the sutta says, involves holding to a conceit. All conflict involves holding to a conceit, a craving, or a view. At the root of all conflict is clinging to these things. Krishnamurti, whom I love, said that meditation is the freeing of the mind from all symbols, images, and remembrances. So in other words, it's to see without the burden of the past, to free oneself from the burden of memory. It's to free oneself from the identity, or clinging to the identity, more precisely. It's to free oneself from clinging to a view. So if we want to free the mind, we need to have the ability to look at a person without being bound up in our own desire, without being bound up in the view, without being bound up in our own identity. So coming back to my daughter in Varanasi and the story of the bombing. She was on her way to meet a friend of mine, and they were a couple of men And they were absolutely fabulous in terms of taking care of her in this situation. So I'm ever grateful to them. One was an Egyptian man, another an Indian man. And the gorgeous Egyptian man called Mohammed, who runs a cafe in Varanasi, some of you might know him, took her in a rickshaw through the chaos of the bombings and took her all the way back to her hotel, where the hotel owner quickly locked her inside. And he did this because he knew that bombings in Varanasi, and the major one was at a Hindu temple. It was at a Hindu temple during a wedding ceremony. So it was horrific. And the person leading the ceremony at the time is a very dear friend of mine, Dr. Mishra, who's the Mahant of Varanasi. So he's a priest, the main priest in Varanasi, and also an engineer. So he was leading the chanting. And he said it was the worst thing he's ever seen in his whole life, that there were body parts everywhere. And in that moment, he thought, the ceremony actually needs to go on. So unwaveringly, he kept on chanting. Of course, while people came and tried to help, and it was incredibly chaotic. After that, of course, outside the gates of the temple, a huge crowd gathered, wanting revenge. The assumption was, of course, that it was a Muslim group who had put the bomb there in the Hindu temple, and the city is actually divided into different sections, and so it was ripe for explosive riots and killing. So outside the temple gate, people gathered. It was such a serious situation that the Prime Minister of India also came, and a leader from the Muslim community came, and the three of them stood there and they faced the crowd. And Mahanshi is a man of great wisdom and presence and dignity, and he spoke to the crowd and told them that revenge isn't the way. That even though they had such painful feelings about what had happened, that they should go home and stay quiet and not seek revenge. So at first they did. And then, rather wisely, the whole Muslim part of the city, who were equally horrified by what had happened, by the way, shut down as a tribute to those who had been killed. And then some musicians, some Muslim musicians, came to the Hindu temple, and as a gesture of goodwill and peace, they played Hindu songs. So this, in India, is an extraordinary event. So the musicians let go of their identity as belonging to a particular religion, or tradition, or history. And they played music, Hindu music, in the temple. And after some days and lots of speeches by Mahanshi, the city quietened. And he said, I have more visitors now from the Muslim community than I do from the Hindu community. And my daughter said that the events and the way that it was handled actually brought the communities together. So it was a beautiful example of not going with the heat of the emotion, that's bound up with the desire for revenge, bound up with the view, bound up with identifying with a particular religion. In this case. So to understand a little more about views, I want to tell you another story. It's a bit of a lighter story, this one, in a way. In Tasmania, also, Tasmania is a state of Australia. It's an island sitting off the bottom of Australia. And on that island, there's a number of mines. I think they're actually diamond mines. And the mines, does everyone know what a mine is? Yeah? The mines are really deep underground, like more than a kilometer underground. And so the mining itself triggered an underground earthquake, and the tunnels in the mine fell in, and three of the miners were trapped. It's a very archetypal image, trapped in the darkness, trapped under the earth. So after a day or so, the rescue workers found the body of one man. And then they thought that surely the other two were also dead as well. But still they searched. However, this was not the case. The two men actually survived 14 days under the ground and were rescued. Initially, just after the earthquake, one of the men was buried, he was under the ground, buried up to his neck in rock. He called for help. Silence. He called for help again and eventually heard a voice. He couldn't undo himself because his arms were also underneath the rock and just his head was poking out. He said he thought every breath was his last. And he started to go into a panic. And then somebody else came, another survivor. And so he began the task of taking down the rocks. And so the rocks had to be taken away really systematically and stacked because the area these two men were in was very small, just 3 meters by 2 meters. And they couldn't stand up. So, the first thing they did, one man freed the other. And then, in the dark, they began to speak to each other. They did have some lights, a torch, but they didn't want to use it all because they didn't know how long they'd be there. So they spoke to each other in the dark. Now, can you imagine the papancha? Can you imagine what you would think? You're 1 kilometer under the ground. It's very hot. And there you are. So the thoughts and the fears and the projections began for them. One man was extremely frightened. So they didn't really know each other, these two men. And so they started to talk. So, like most Australian men, they started off with, "What sort of cars do you like?" And you know what? They couldn't agree. One liked Fords and the other liked Holdens. And they were completely at odds about this business of the cars. So then they said to each other, "What do you do on weekends?" And one said, "Oh, I love to go shooting and fishing." And the other one said, "Oh, I don't like to kill animals." So again, they couldn't find any common ground. They couldn't find a single thing about which to agree. Then I said, oh, well, what kind of music do you like? Oh, and one said, I like country music. And the other one said, I can't stand country music. I like rock music. And so on. So imagine that. This could be the very last day of your life. You're with another human being. It could be the last person you see on this earth. And there's absolutely no connection. And there's no connection because of holding to views. The view divides. The view separates. And then, of course, as the days went by, at first, of course, they thought someone will come, but they didn't. So 5 days later, here they are. And by this time, they'd begun to talk about other things. They'd begun to talk about their families and the fact that they might not see them ever again. And so they had some pens with them. They must have had some pens in their pocket. So they wrote goodbye letters to their family on their bodies. What would you say? So they wrote the goodbye letters and then they read them to each other. And it was this that began a friendship. It was only when they discovered that they both had something in common, that they did actually love their families, that there could be some kind of meeting of these two very, very different personalities. Eventually, they heard the sounds of blasting, of explosions of their rescuers coming to get them. But with each explosion, their little cave, underground cave, kept falling in. And so with each explosion, they wrote the date and time on their bodies so that when their dead bodies were found, people would know how long they lived. They shouted and shouted to the rescuers, "We're alive, we're alive." Eventually, somebody heard. And then, of course, eventually the rescuers managed to make a small hole through to the two trapped people. And then, of course, they said, "What would you like?" And they said things like, "Eggs and bacon." They wanted some food. And the rescuers said, "Sorry, you have to have yogurt." And they'd never eaten yogurt before, but the dietitian said, "No, they haven't eaten for so many days. If they have eggs and bacon, they'll get sick. They have to have yogurt." So the yogurt got passed through the hole. And this is really funny in Australia. And then one of the guys said, "Well, what I really want..."
Beer.
No, he didn't say beer. I think he might have, actually. I think you're right. That's a good guess. The beer was a no-no, too. The next thing he said was, "I want a Saturday's paper." They said, "What do you want a paper for?" And he said, "To look for another job." So this was reported all over the nation. And of course, we were all just glued to our television sets. This drama of the rescue had been going on and on and on. I think it's the first time I've ever watched television continuously, because I really couldn't wait to see what had happened. It was like the whole The hearts of the nation were really in this rescue. And the humour was extraordinary. And of course, the humour breaks down the division. The humour helps release us from the fear, helps free the mind from the fear. And so eventually they pass through a few things to make them more comfortable, some things to lie on, a mat, and some water and other things like that, to go with the yogurt. And so they said, well, how are you now? And one of them said, it's great. It's 2-star, and we're the 2 stars. So this is Australian humour. So the rescue effort took 9 days. And during this 9 days, every 15 minutes there was an explosion. Every 15 minutes, these two men thought at any moment death would come. That's enough to wake us up, isn't it? Imagine that. Not knowing if you live or die, every 15 minutes, pretty good chance of dying. Interviewed afterwards, one of them said, I died every time. Every time there was an explosion, I died. And when they were asked what got them through the ordeal, they both agreed that it was love that got them through. So these two big, tough Australian miners are there being interviewed on television. They're saying it's love that got us through. It's love that crossed the divide between us and allowed us to be friends. And the friendship was totally important to our survival. And this love, of course, transcends the vastly different views that we tend to have and cling to and hold on to. So, to understand this sutta, it's important that each of us notice how we contribute to pain and suffering, hatred and aggression, conflicts and differences. We need to see into the way we distort our perceptions, the way we project our wishes and our desires onto others. The way we hold to any kind of division. This is the freeing of the mind. And the Buddha said in the final part of this sutta, when one understands the Honeyball Sutta, this is the end of resorting to rods and weapons, of quarrels, brawls, disputes, recrimination, malicious words, and false speech. Here these evil, unwholesome states cease without remainder. So when we let go of craving, when we let go of view, when we see the emptiness of identifying with self, there's the opportunity for the freeing of the mind. The great philosopher of India, Nagarjuna, describes it like this. He says, the life process has no thing that distinguishes it from freedom. Freedom has no thing that distinguishes it from the life process. And then he goes on to say, it's unannihilated, non-eternal. So in other words, our freedom is the middle path between or annihilationism and eternalism. So it involves not clinging to either of those views. It's non-ceased, it's non-arisen. So our deep, profound freedom has nothing to do with coming and going, arising and ceasing. This is kind of hard to get the mind around. It's best understood through the direct experience. The Buddha said often that apart from conditions, there's no arising in consciousness. And just to conclude, a poem from Nagarjuna. You are not the same as or different from conditions on which you depend. You are neither severed from nor forever fused with them. This is the deathless teaching of Buddhas who care for the world. So when we are no longer caught up with our clinging, we see or recognize the mind that is luminous, the mind that is unbound. The mind that is, if you like, unfabricated, not put together by any thing. This is to know reality. And to know reality, we find the freedom in the midst of our life. We find it by touching our humanity. We find it by crossing the divide between cultures, religions, and so on. Someone came to me today and described his experience as light. As seeing the light of awareness, shining the light of awareness. And this light of awareness reveals to us our freedom. Hafiz poem. It goes like this. Some of you probably know it. It's sweet. Sweet like the honey bowl, and you understand it. I have learned so much, of course. I have learned so much from God that I can no longer call myself a Christian, a Hindu, a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Jew. The truth has shared so much of itself with me that I can no longer call myself a man, a woman, an angel, or even pure soul. Love has befriended Hafiz so completely, it has turned to ash and freed me of every concept and image my mind has ever known. May all beings come from the darkness into the light of awareness and wisdom. May all beings see into the process of papancha and cling nowhere. And may all beings realize the utter free nature of mind, the mind that's unrestricted.